tonight we're going to understand holiness in a completely new way. The first time I encountered this, you could even say it blew my mind. I had to read it over and over again because it didn't track with what I had known all along. But the more and more I've thought about this approach to holiness, the more I'm certain that it is true, and the more I see it sort of play out in every other instance that holiness may arise. And so before I ask you what you think holiness is, I want to share with you a story from Rabbi Yisachar Fran of Baltimore. Because Rabbi Fran, he tells a story about this guy, and this guy's very excited. He is in the play. And, okay, he's not the best actor in the world. He doesn't have one of these big parts. He has just one line. One line, and that's it. And what's that line? Hark! I hear the sound of the cannon. And, not surprisingly, his job in the play is that when the cannon goes off, he's supposed to say, hark! I hear the sound of the cannon. And for like a month, the guy is getting ready. And yeah, you can imagine maybe we know some people like this. Maybe we are people like this. You know, when you're in a play, but you don't have that much to do in the play, you put in just as much time and effort as the person who's leading it. Just, you know, they're practicing hundreds of lines and you're practicing one line. And so this guy goes everywhere. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, in the car, sitting on the couch. Hark! I hear the sound of the cannon. And so, sure enough, the day finally arrives. He's so excited. And, you know, the play is going on, and he knows his line is coming up, and all of a sudden the cannon fires. Boom! And what does he say? What was that? And even if we talk about something, even if we prepare for something, even if we think about it, if we've never really encountered it properly, if we don't really know what a cannon sounds like, then I won't know that I'm supposed to say my line, hark, I hear the sound of the cannon. And so that's what's going to happen with holiness as well. That we talk about holiness, we encounter holiness in a lot of ways, but I wonder, have we really understood what holiness is? Are we able to pinpoint it? Or when holiness comes around, do we let it slide by? Do we say, whoa, what was that? I don't know what I just experienced. And I guess after that somewhat ambiguous introduction, is anyone brave enough? I should have prefaced maybe with this question. Is anyone brave enough to share with our friends? When you think of holiness, what comes to mind?
Someone who's pious.
Oh, so when we talk about holy individuals, you know, a pious individual. Okay, I hear. That definitely is something comes to mind for me as well. Anyone else want to jump in? And so I hear that comes to mind for me. I think of a holiness as a personality type, as an individual. A person can emanate holiness. You know, maybe I'll associate holiness with certain things, certain experiences. Maybe I'll associate holiness with places. Maybe there are places that are more or less holy. And when I'm thinking in and around these thoughts of holiness, there seems to be some sort of underarching theme. But okay, can we articulate that? When we talk about all these different things that are holy, you know, if I tell you yes, Doris, what?
I think Doris.
Oh, all right. Welcome, Doris. So good to see you again. And I'm sure we'll have.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening. We'll have a chance to hear from you again, I'm sure, very soon. And so, when we think about holiness, if we want to define it, we want to understand what this is, well, we have to see, where does holiness come up? And I think for those of us who pray on a daily basis, holiness is right there, front and center, at the start of our prayer services. And so while this is not a learning session about tefillah, about davening, I'm hoping that next time we get together, we can talk about davening on Friday night, about Kabbat Shabbat. But this time around, we're going to talk about the Shemoneh Esrei, the Amidah. And as we're likely aware, during the week, we have these 19 blessings. We call it the Shemoneh Esrei, but there was another one tacked on, and I guess Tisha Esrei doesn't sound as good as Shemoneh Esrei. And so we have the 19 blessings. But it's not a real 19 blessings. It's really three distinct sections of blessings. And so in the beginning, we have three blessings. At the end, we have three blessings. And then in the middle, there are 13. And those 13 blessings are what we might call the requests. And that's why on Shabbat or on Yom Tov, it'll look different. On Shabbat, we'll have just one blessing. On Yom Tov, we'll have just one blessing. And on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there's one blessing. Rosh Hashanah and Musaf, there's actually three, but generally, on a Shabbat or Yom Tov, instead of 19 blessings, we'll have just seven. But we're always going to have the same three in the beginning and the same three at the end. We're likely familiar with this. Many of us have been praying for many, many years. And so those three in the beginning, three at the end, those aren't requests in the same sense. Those serve a different function. And those three in the beginning are what we call Shavach, we call praise. And those three blessings are apparently about praising God. And we're going to understand what that means. And we're not really going to unpack it, but just so that we know, the final three, beginning with Ritzeh and ending with the final blessing of peace, are prayers of thanks. And you know, and so we basically start out Shemoneh Esrei, we praise God, and then we have the request section, which during the week is 13 blessings. And then at the end, we have those final three blessings, basically saying, thank you for your audience, thanks for talking to me. And I want to look at those first three blessings, because in those first three blessings, we encounter Kedusha, we encounter holiness, but it doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense to me. I'll explain to you why. And this is sort of going to be the focal point of where we're going to start off and where we're going to go. And if I don't break for questions after this, please remind me, because I wouldn't want to lose anyone. This is not as technical as some of the shiurim we've had, although maybe we'll get back to that at some point. But still, this is an important point for us to understand. And so those first three blessings are meant to praise. And so it's not that. And so on the one hand, maybe we're saying we're praising God. You know, I'm about to make these big requests. I'm about to ask God for wisdom and for health and for sustenance and to bring back the exiles and to build Jerusalem. There's a lot of big things. It's going to take a big God to do so. And so I need to praise God before God's willing to say yes. That's one way of looking at the Amidah, but I'm not really a fan. It doesn't speak to me. What speaks to me much more is thinking about the structure of our prayer service as not really talking to God, but talking to me. So how are these talking to me? Well, we have our first three blessings, and then you'll feel free to grab a siddur at home and just open up to any of the Amidahs throughout. Chakras, Menachem Maariv, Shabbos, Yontif, doesn't make a difference. It's always the same three. I remember being in kindergarten, when we first got our Siddurim, and I had friends who were flipping to other parts of the Siddur where there was other versions of the Shemoneh Esrei. We didn't understand what we were looking at. We just saw, oh, look, Baruch, Baruch. And so it was very exciting for us. And the teacher had to like stop us. Like, you're saying the wrong thing. It's not the right move. You got to stay on the right page. So feel free to open up your Siddur to whatever page you so choose. And let's look at the first blessing. Because the first blessing is what we call Magen Avot. This is the blessing where we point out, we declare that God, that this God that we're talking to is the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And on the one hand, it's like, yeah, God, you know me, so you should listen to what I have to say. But on the other hand, it's the opposite, that I'm connecting to this God who isn't just some random individual, this random figure. This is someone who I've known and my family has known my entire life. This is a deep family connection. And so I don't know if anyone's had this experience when when you spend time studying in Israel. Thank God many of our high schoolers will spend a year abroad. They call it gap year, which is probably the worst term of any program, because gap year implies that it's devoid of anything valuable, whereas this is in so many ways the most valuable year of so many students' lives, and where they get a direction and a sense of purpose and who they are. But during that time, but after graduating high school and before they have embarked on their formal college career, that time period where someone might spend time in Israel, many people will go to visit not even relatives, but family friends. And you show up and it might not be so comfortable, but there's a little bit of comfort in, you know, them telling you, oh, I know your parents, I know your grandparents. And so even though this is in some ways an absolute stranger, there's some level of kinship that you know my family. And so I start the conversation with God, and I'm almost thinking like, God, you're so big. You're so huge. How can I connect to God? Well, step one is, this isn't God who created the whole world. This is God who knows me. He knows my family. And so maybe I can have a conversation. Maybe I can connect to God Almighty, because it's not just God Almighty. This is also someone that my family knows. That's the first blessing. Second blessing is similar. It talks about the strength of God. And maybe this one is not saying, oh, I can approach God, but it's, okay, so this is this divine being that's talking to me, but why should he talk to me? Why should I talk to him? If this person's talking to me, I'm not so impressive. And so if I'm not impressive, maybe God's not so impressive either. And so then we say, we have this bracha of Gevuros, of Mechai HaMesim. God can do anything. God is all-powerful. God can literally bring people back from the dead. And God can bring rain. Rain being something that is so average, so mundane, it's a nuisance to us. And bring someone back from the dead is the greatest of all miracles we could ever imagine. Both of those are just as easy for the God above. And so while the first blessing is sort of developing a kinship, that second blessing is saying, all right, you're about to talk to someone who can do anything. Don't hold yourself back. You can get whatever, ask for whatever you might need right now, because you're about to talk to the bringer of rains, the one who can bring people back to life. And then a third blessing. And so what would we imagine should be the third blessing? That third sort of introduction, if you will. That third praise, not in the buttering up God up sense, but in the, I'm trying to find another way to connect, another avenue to connect before my specific requests. Well, let's think about it. And you know what? Let's open up a seat door. We're sitting here anyway. It's nice to be at home. We said Avot, we said Gevurot, and now we get to the blessing of Atah Kadosh. Now, I'm using an interlinear sitter just because there's the one there, although it's probably a good idea. So we say Atah Kadosh, you are holy, Vishimcha Kadosh, and your name is holy, Ukadoshim b'chol yom yahalu chasela, and your holy ones every day are praising you. What does it mean to be holy? Well, we can look at the bottom of the article sitter. We can look at a lot of places. A lot of people will tell you that holy, in the context of God, means separate. Holy means separate. That's what I've learned throughout my life, that holy means separate. So God, I know you. You know my family. God, you're all powerful. I can ask you anything. And God, you're separate. You're removed. You're far, far, far away. This is the third blessing. This is how I'm getting geared up to talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How's that helpful? God, you're so holy. You're far beyond anything that I could ever possibly imagine. You are bigger and better than I can ever develop some sort of connection to. How in the world is that supposed to make me feel like I should talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How is that going to bring me closer to God that I can now start my conversation? And to that, I open the floor. Does anyone have any thoughts? I obviously have my own. Sometimes rabbis start problems, but usually we wrap them up afterward. But I'm curious to hear what anyone else might have to say. So in the absence of our friends who might be occupied with dinner or otherwise, maybe we could suggest, and this is a thought really that occurred to me even as I'm talking, it's interesting that the Maharal, Rabbi Judah Lowy, of the 1500s Kabbalist of Prague, the Maharal of Prague, who unfortunately is famous for the Golem when there's so much more to him, he actually writes that when someone's talking, they're not thinking. And so it's possible that someone would not fulfill their mitzvah of learning Torah when they're teaching Torah because they're not learning anything, they're thinking. They're not thinking. And in order to learn, you have to think. I don't know what that means. I don't understand what he's saying, even though generally I've put a tremendous value on what the Maharal says, because I find that some of my greatest insights are while learning with people, while learning in groups like this. If I say something and I'm thinking, someone's going to catch me on this. This is a sharp group. So does this really make sense? So that's both in the preparation, but even in the moment. So maybe we'll throw out an answer before getting to the one that we're really looking for. But maybe one approach is, why do we say that God's separate, that God is sort of far beyond anything I could ever imagine? Because if I begin this whole conversation saying, God's willing to talk to me, and God's super strong and super capable, understand that as much as God's super capable, that God's involved in the world, as much as God is my God, the God of my forefathers, connected to little Ari Zucker, at the same time, understand that you're not hanging out with a buddy. We're not wearing sweatpants when we're getting up to daven. This is a formal attire procedure. This is something in which we need to really be focused, because we're about to have a conversation with someone who is far beyond separate, beyond anything we can ever imagine. So maybe that's one answer, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad answer, but let's think about this more. And I'll tell you why this is, I guess, troublesome to me. thankfully, basically throughout my whole life, I've been what you might call a ma'amin. I've been a believer. I never really struggled with a lot of Jewish questions. And because I never really struggled with those questions, it was very important to me to become educated about sort of those topics, because I felt like it was something that I, as a Torah personality, as an educator, and really just as like a well-rounded person, I wanted to understand, you know. And there are so many people who have questions about God and about this whole idea of monotheism. What's bothering them so much when this sort of comes so easily to me? And so one of the I guess big theories that exists out there is something called the watchmaker theory. Anyone ever heard of the watchmaker theory? Can you just give me a nod? No? Okay. So I'll preface and say that this is what we call kfira. This is heresy, meaning this is entirely antithetical to Jewish belief. The Torah does not preach this. This is against Torah values. It's understandable why somebody might think this, and in the way the world looks today, I'm not surprised that people think this, but I am not encouraging anyone to follow this view. I'm not espousing this view. I am only explaining this as a contrast to what I disagree with and what I think that our Torah tradition disagrees with. Now, with that introduction, the watchmaker theory is as follows. A watchmaker might make a watch. Someone from Citizen made this watch. It's a very, very nice watch. I've had it for a long time. And what was involved in that watch? Well, watches are complicated things. Watches have all the gears and the widgets and the shiny things. And watches have a lot inside them. And they don't just come together on their own. To assume that the world came together on its own is like near absurd. So there had to have been an intelligent designer. You know, someone had to design the world. Much like a watch couldn't just pop up out of nowhere, a watch had to be created by a watchmaker. However, what happens with a watchmaker? Somebody made this watch, and then for my 12-year-old birthday, can't believe it still works. Well, it died a few times, but for my 12-year-old birthday, they sold it to me, and I've had it since then. Now, a couple of times I brought it back to the watchmaker. It wasn't literally that one, but to a watchmaker, you know, either to extend the links because my wrist has thankfully grown since I was 12, or you know, because it stopped. But the watch is more or less functioning on its own, but for a few moments in which it comes back to its maker, to the watchmaker for a quick fix. And like a watchmaker, this theory that we don't agree with says the world is like a watch. God, this new divine being, created the world and then stepped out. And the watchmaker might not see the watch for another 25 years, might see the watch throughout the whole life of the watch once, twice, three times. So too, God will pop in once in a while. Yeah, maybe there was this whole leaving Egypt situation. Maybe God split the sea. But that was just sort of a one-off. God is not intimately involved in the world on a regular basis. This idea we do not believe in. This is an idea that we explicitly speak out against anytime we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim, anytime we mention leaving of Egypt, which is something we do every day, whether it's saying in the Shema, whether it's in the tefillin that we wear, whether it's something we mention on Friday night in our Kiddush, we don't believe that. But this whole idea of a watchmaker theory is amongst I believe one of the strongest, one of the most common arguments against God running the world, against sort of Jewish ideals. Effectively, what's it saying? The watchmaker theory is effectively saying God's separate, God's removed, God's far, far away. And so, in my Shemon Esrei, every single day, I say, God, you're far away. Someone easily could say, yeah, God's like a watchmaker. So on a daily basis, three times a day, I am espousing an idea that sounds a lot like, that sounds very similar to something that is entirely against our religion. Why is this the focus? Why is this how I'm opening up my conversation with the divine? That's what I want to try and understand tonight. But I would also like to connect to what we're coming to in very shortly, to the holiday of Purim. And well, I guess we'll look at it from two different perspectives, this holiday of Purim. Because on Purim, we do something we don't ordinarily do. Because the notion of having a mitzvah on a holiday is very common to us. We love mitzvahs on holiday. We design them as little kids. You know, we spend lots of money on them. We get excited about them. We put up signs. We love the various mitzvot specific for the holiday. Rosh Hashanah, we love blowing shofar. Lulav, we love lulav and esrog on sukkahs and in the sukkah. We love eating matzah on Pesach. But Purim has some mitzvos, one of which is reading the Megillah. That's a specific mitzvah for the day, which we don't see on many of the other holidays. You know, we might read something that corresponds to the holiday, but we usually don't read for the sake of the holiday. But Purim, we do. And Purim, we don't just read something. We don't just read Megillah Esther, but we read it at nighttime and in the daytime. And that doesn't happen that much, because think about it. We don't blow shofar at night and the daytime. We don't shake lulav at night and the daytime. We do sit in the sukkah, that's true, but we don't have a mitzvah per se to eat matzah at night and the day. We eat matzah during the daytime because there's no bread around, but unless you're the Vilna Gaon, there's no mitzvah to eat matzah beyond the Seder night. That being said, I try to fulfill the opinion of the Vilna Gaon from the 1700s, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, who says, no, there's a mitzvah every single day of Pesach to eat a piece of matzah, and so I try to do that every day. But for the most part, on a service level, mitzvot are either nighttime or daytime, and not both. And so why is Purim this sort of combination of night and day? If I ask you what the holiest episode in Tanakh is, I'm going to assume people are still occupied and unable to jump in. But I've asked groups this before, I've thought about it before, and I think most people will say something along the lines of, you know, receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai, or the splitting of the Red Sea, or something to that effect, something where there's sort of a grandiose gesture of the divine. Is that fair? Oh, I'm getting so. You can jump in with something else. You're welcome. All right, I'm not going to push. That's often what I'll hear, and that's often what I might think. But we don't see that taking place on Purim, and I'm not convinced that that's genuinely the holiest time. Because there is a fascinating and somewhat surprising passage in the Talmud, in the Gemara, on Masechet Shabbat, on page 118b, on Kuf Yudches Amud Beis, from Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi is one of the well-known, well-respected rabbis of the Tanaim, and he says that he wishes that he could be one of those people who says Hallel on a daily basis. Now, Hallel, we're familiar with. Hallel, we say on Pesach, we say on Rosh Chodesh. Hallel is sort of singing the praises of God. And the subject matter of those verses, those chapters of Hallel, are really focusing on leaving Egypt, which is why, in a lot of contexts in the Gemara, it's called Hallel HaMitzri. Now, it doesn't mean the Egyptian Hallel. It's not what the Egyptians sang, but it's Hallel that espouses the miracles that took place when we left Egypt. And Rabbi Yossi says, I would love if I could sing the Hallel of those who left Egypt. I could sing about that on a daily basis. That'd be great. And the Gemara says something unbelievable. Rabbi Yossi wants to sing about this on a daily basis. And the Gemara says, anyone who does that is a blasphemer. He's a Zakar from a Gadif. Rabbi Yossi, like, okay, like maybe you're overdoing it a little bit. You know, some days we just need to like hang out and chill. We can't be super excited and jumping up and down on a daily basis. But that makes you a blasphemer to want to sing praises of God for having taken us out of Egypt, for creating miracles? Mapiton, what's going on here? So, let's think about this. And with this, we're going to understand Hallel a little bit, but we're really going to understand what the difference is, if you will, between Pesach and Purim. Because Pesach is sort of the paradigmatic holiday with the miracles. Tons of miracles going on. You've got the plagues, you've got splitting of the sea. And Purim, what miracles take place? Seems like nothing. You very easily could argue, nothing. And so Rabbi Yossi is saying, I want to sing praises to God every day like it's Pesach. And the Gemara says, you got to live with Purim also. Purim is an essential part of our lives. Now, we're not going to unpack what that means just yet. We're going to build one step even further. Let's take a look inside the Megillah to really understand. The whole Megillah story is a lot shorter than we think about. You know, there are 10 chapters in the Megillah, but the first two chapters are kind of setting the stage. And we're not really in the story. We don't like really learn about that much about Esther until really the third chapter. Haman, and you know, the big bad is introduced in the third chapter. And the story almost seems like it's over well before 10. Already in like, you know, 6, 7, I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, let's wrap it up. And it just kind of keeps going and going. But without question, the chapter 5 is the focal point, the big moment in the Megillah. Because in chapter 5, Esther, after having fasted for 3 days, is now going into the palace, into the throne room of Ahasuerus, of the king. And we can discuss another time what some of the rabbis' commentaries about that, you know, the significance of her going in, whereas she never before had she actually voluntarily gone in. She was always forced to go, and this time around she's going on her own, of her own volition, and what that means to her, to the relationship that she has. But we can't get into that now. We can only hint at it. But now Esther's entering into the palace, and this is a big moment. She's fasted for 3 days. The Jewish people have fasted for 3 days. This is, if she knows any of her Jewish history, this is the miracle moment. This is the moment where water is going to turn into blood. This is the moment where a Caesar is going to split. God is going to snap his fingers, and boom, we've got a miracle. The Jewish people are saved from the wicked hands of Haman and Ahasuerus. And as she's entering into the palace, there's a chapter of Tehillim that describes her experience. Now, David HaMelech was a king before the construction of the first temple, and Esther is queen after the destruction of the first temple. So we're talking 400 or so years apart, but seemingly through some level of prophecy, King David taps into what her experience is like. And so in chapter 22, it's talking about the Ayelas HaShachar, you know, the deer of the dawn. But I will see. But Ayelas HaShachar also really just means sort of the awakening of the dawn, the growth of dawn. And the rabbis in Masechet Yoma tell us that the Ayelas HaShachar, who is this chapter 22 in Tehillim talking about, in Psalms talking about? It's talking about Esther, and because Esther is the Ayelas HaShachar. Esther is the awakening of the dawn. What makes Esther awakening the dawn? We're about to find out. Esther's walking into the throne room, and she all of a sudden no longer feels any sort of divine support. And she walks past the many idols that existed in Persia at the time, and what they say, the Shekhinah, the divine presence of God, left. And that, now, oftentimes in our liturgy, people refer to God the male. Obviously, God is not male. That is sort of an absurdity. God is sometimes referred to in the male and sometimes in the female, based more off of, you know, I guess we could say, classic male-female characteristics. Everyone is both male and female. This is tangential, but worthwhile. The Shekhinah leaves Esther. Shekhinah, you might have noticed, if anyone who's acutely listening and well-versed in Hebrew, Shekhinah is a feminine, and when God is dwelling amongst us, when God is very, very close, we refer to God in the feminine, because that closeness that is more indicative of a mother, like, you know, one who maybe raised the child within her womb, as opposed to the external raising of a father who is involved, but as much as I would like to be, my wife's 8 months pregnant, and she's much closer to our baby than I am, that notion of Shekhinah in the feminine has now left her. And Esther, who might have felt like she's got God's supportive hand on her back, you might like she's got her mommy holding onto her hand, doesn't have that anymore. And Esther says, "Kaili, Kaili, lama azavtani? My God, why have you left me?" Azavtani doesn't mean left; it means abandoned. Why have you abandoned me in my time of great need? And there are songs about this, and this is one of the most painful chapters of Tehillim, because it's God, why have you abandoned me? You know, last night I was at a Tehillim rally. Last night I was at a prayer service coordinated by Chabad in the local Chicago area for the sake of our brothers and sisters out in Ukraine and really everyone in the Russia-Ukraine area. And one of the chapters that we read was this chapter 22 of Kaili Kaili Lama Azavtani, God, in my time of need, why does it feel like you've abandoned me? And Esther is walking into the throne room and thinking just that, God, I've been abandoned. And says Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, says the Rav, he's one of the most formative rabbis of Yeshiva University, who passed away actually the same year I was born, but whose thought has tremendously influenced me and who created a paradigm shift for me in what holiness means. Buckle up. Esther's walking in, and she is convinced that God is nowhere to be found. She's expecting God to make a miracle for her. But God says, I'm not making a miracle. You're making a miracle. You're going to create that miracle right now. And Esther understands that this is going to be a different kind of holiday. This is going to be a different kind of redemption. Because we're used to redemptions with the big God, with God making miracles, with God doing things that are beyond belief, where God's splitting the sea, where God stops the sun, where God causes entire armies to just drop dead somehow. And Esther's expecting those, and none of those happen. And she, even though she thinks that God abandons her, what she comes to understand is Atah Kadosh. She says the words Atah Kadosh in the seventh line of the Tehillim. She says, God, you're holy. And what that means is not, God forbid, God, that you're separate, that you're removed, that you're no longer involved in the world, but God, you're holy, meaning that whereas maybe I thought that you were going to take care of it, what instead it means that I'm going to take care of it. Kedusha is when we are active in the world. Kedusha is when we make miracles happen. Kedusha is when Esther goes into the throne room and comes up with her own scheme, comes up with a whole elaborate plot to convince the king that she and Haman might be having an affair. So he's freaking out. And so he ends up rewarding Mordecai, and Haman ends up being falling over it and meaning his downfall. All of that through Esther's, what's the word? There's a great word. Esther's machinations are the ones that make it happen. There are no miracles. There's no hail with fire on the inside shooting down. Haman and his people are stopped through political miracles. And we might argue, that's not so impressive. There's nothing miraculous about that. That's the holiest holiday that we have. This is the holiest moment that we have. Because I might think that God revealing himself on Mount Sinai, God revealing himself at the splitting of the Red Sea is a holy moment. But, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, those moments are not holy. They're special. They're incredible. They're the reason why the world was created, so that we could develop a connection to their divine. But they're not holy. Kedusha is when I create space for God in the world. When I make miracles. You know, how do we say miracle in Hebrew? We say nes. But nes doesn't just mean something miraculous, something outside of nature. Nes also means a flag. And maybe our job is to create a flag to God. Our job is to create a moment where, despite no miracles taking place, nothing out of the ordinary happening, I create an experience where someone says, wow, God is here. God is involved. God is making this happen. When you finish the Megillah story, no one has any doubt in their mind that God was orchestrating it all along. But it's not clear. It's not written in the text. The Megillah, ironically, is a book that doesn't include God's name. Nowhere where we'll see Yud Kei Vav Kei will we see that name that we're used to saying and seeing in our Siddurim. Instead, we only see the word Hamelech, and it takes the Vilna Gaon's commentary for him to say that anytime it says the word Hamelech, not Melech Achashverosh, but just Hamelech, the king, it's not talking about Achashverosh. Sorry, the Gemara says it's not the Vilna Gaon. Anytime it says Melech, Hamelech, it's referring to the king, the king above. But you wouldn't have known that on your own. That wouldn't be obvious. And that's why the Purim story is the greatest story of a hidden holiness, a hidden Kedusha. Because Kedusha is when God lets us perform, and God doesn't perform on his own. God doesn't say, sit back, I got this. Instead, he says, I'm going to see what you can do. Because, you know, it's both a halacha, a law on the Rambam, and a famous aphorism. The Rambam says, has a ladder, if you will. He has a hierarchy of the greatest kind of tzedakah, of charity someone could give. And we're nearing a holiday of Purim, half a significant part of the holiday, the most significant on a monetary scale is gifts to the poor, of matanos le'avyonim. People, unfortunately, will spend $1,000 putting together their shalach manos that they're sharing with their friends, and spend tons of money on the festive meal. And you know, the donations is an $18 donation to the synagogue. It should be reversed. Your friends are fine. Give everyone a nice little subtle, modest shalach manos. Have a nice suda, and then donate all the money that you were going to spend to matanos le'avyonim. In this context, right now, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, the head of YU, is highly recommending that everyone's gifts to the poor not just go to those locals. We shouldn't abandon those, God forbid, but that there should be additional levels of gifts to the poor, not just those who are monetarily poor, but who are poor in refugee camps, people who are running away from Ukraine, our brothers and sisters who are suffering so much in Eastern Europe. Our gifts to the poor for next week should definitely go in that direction. And the Rambam, when he's discussing what is the most ideal form of charity, he says something that I find surprising. Because he talks about, you know, a low level is when you give begrudgingly, when you give without a smile, as opposed to giving with a smile, when you give anonymously, is a higher level. But at the highest level of tzedakah, the highest level of charity, is not giving at all. The highest level of charity is hiring someone, giving someone a job, making them work for their money, giving someone a loan that they're going to pay back. Not just a free gift. Here's $1,000. No, I'm giving you $1,000, and I'm going to be back next week, and you owe me $10. I'll be back the week after that, and over the course of the next 2 years, you're going to pay me back all the money you owe. Obviously, there's not going to be any interest. Jews don't charge each other interest. But the confidence, the responsibility that the Rambam is telling us to instill in a person, that I'm not giving this to you. You're doing it on your own. That halakha exists not just in the context of charity, but that's how God treats us. Charity, in general, is something that emanates from the way God acts. God is charitable. God is generous. And so too we are generous with others. And so if God's ultimate generosity is that of Kedusha, of holiness, where he says, you take care of it, I'm going to give you the tools necessary, so too, when I give charity, I should give someone the tools rather than just giving them a free gift. And it exists in the aphorism also. You know, teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a day. Give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. We're so much better off giving someone the tools so that they can do it on their own and not just receive it from, you know, my generosity, from me feeling good. Oh, I'm a big tzaddik. I'm very impressive that I'm making this happen for the individual. And so we began trying to understand, why does our Shemona Esrei, why does our daily prayer open in such a strange way? Because I'm getting to know God and I feel like I have a family connection. And I realize that God is all powerful. And then I said, God, you're holy. And if holy means separate, then God, you're so far away. You are separate from the world. That doesn't sound like a praise. That sounds like a curse. That sounds like something you say that you should never ever say, let alone on a constant basis, daily, both personally and publicly. But now we can understand. Now what does it mean when we say, God, you're holy? We're saying, God, even though you have a relationship with me, even though you love me and you care about me, and you've been watching over me and my family and my ancestors for so long, and the only thing that you want is for me to succeed, you're holy, and you're not going to let that happen. And even though you're all-powerful, and you can do anything on the entire spectrum, from making it rain all the way to bringing people back from the dead and everything in between, even though there's nothing that you can't do, nothing is too big or too small, you're going to let me take care of it. God, the way that I start out in my Shemona Esrei is, even though it kind of makes more sense to let you take care of everything, I know that you're going to let me do this. And there's I wasn't planning on saying this, but we're amongst friends. There's a movie called Evan Almighty, and it's the sequel to Bruce Almighty. Evan Almighty, it's not a great movie, but it is a very cute movie, and Steve Carell does like a good job of being Steve Carell. But at the end of the movie, you know, naturally in the screenplay, there's like a whole moment of crisis where like he doesn't know what to do, and his wife is freaking out, and his wife effectively runs away with their children, and they're in some random diner, some random restaurant. And she meets Morgan Freeman. Now, we know that Morgan Freeman plays God, but she doesn't know that. And while it is sacrilegious to assume to ever assume that there's a human form taken by God, I imagine when Morgan Freeman, I guess, to the next world, God's going to say, "You shouldn't have done that." But if it had to be someone, you had the right voice for it at least. And so Morgan Freeman meets Evan Almighty's wife. I don't remember her name, and He says, it's such a beautiful line. And look it up to make sure I got it right. But effectively he says, you know, people think that when we ask God for things, God gives them to us. But that's not it. When God asks for, when we ask for patience, God gives us opportunities to become patient. When we ask for money, God gives us opportunity to build wealth. When God asks, and this is the kicker in the movie, when God asks for more family time, He'll give us some reason why we can't go to work. He'll give us a reason to stay home. And in that whole context, you know, dad's always never home, and then he spends all this time with his kid building an ark and going crazy. And that, coming from a movie, is so much what this is about. They tapped into this yisod from Rabbi Soloveitchik. They must have read the same book I did, because Kedusha, holiness, God doesn't do this for us. God sets us up, gives us the tools, puts us in the right place to take care of it on our own. God coordinated the whole Purim story so that Esther would be in the palace when she needed to be. But then he said, Esther, now it's your turn. Esther did everything she could to not be in the palace. She was taken. First of all, she hid, and eventually they found her. And then she was taken against her will, and they said, you have 6 months to beautify yourself. I don't know what a person could possibly do over the course of 6 months to change the way they look. I guess there was like a very elaborate workout program. But Esther has 6 months to make herself as attractive as possible to the king, and she does nothing. She does not try to impress him in any way, shape, or form. And even so, she ends up winning. She ends up becoming the Queen Esther. And it was all against her will. God makes it all happen. But finally, when push comes to shove, when the miracle had to take place, God said, Esther, now it's your turn. I'm holy. And I'm going to be holy. I'm going to be separate here. I'm going to let you shine. We asked why is Esther called Ayelet HaShachar? Why is she called the breaking of the dawn? Because dawn is an interesting time. Dawn is a time in between darkness and light. It's not really dark and it's not really light yet. The sun's not out, but you can kind of see things. And Rabbi Akiva Tatz explains in his book, As the Dawn Ends the Night. It's on the shelf over there. Anything by Rabbi Akiva Tatz is worthwhile. He's an incredible scholar, an incredible personality, and an incredible writer. But this one I found particularly fascinating, which is all a book just about the development of the oral tradition, effectively. And in it, he writes about how Esther is really sort of that transition in a lot of ways, from a world of the miraculous to a world where God's really letting us do more things on our own. Miracles don't take place as much in the same way. For the first time in history, a holiday is going to be born, not from out of miracles, but from Kedusha, from holiness. Now, of course, the question you should ask is, Hanukkah happens 200 years later, and that's miraculous, and you're right. But for the first time, Esther experiences a miracle without God's overt intervention. This is the first time, and it might happen again. There'll be a few more dips and increases of God's investment and awareness in the world. But overall, Esther's the start of the third blessing, of Atah Kadosh, of God says, I'm going to let you create holiness. And so there's more to unpack. There's more to discuss. I'm happy to field any questions, but that's my spiel for this evening. I hope that this gives us a different perspective on holiness for sure and what we say on a daily basis in our prayers, but also on Purim as well. A perspective on Purim, that Purim is seemingly a story, but it's a story that in which God is effectively saying, I trust you. I trust you to take care of this. This is a story that lasts for all time because God is always saying from this moment on, I'm going to let you take the reins because I believe in you. Thank you so much and have a wonderful night.